Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Experts claim there is nothing tougher than a diamond. But at Diamonds Direct, we beg to differ. Have you ever met a mother? Strong, radiant, timeless. This Mother's Day, give her the gift that meets her match. With diamond jewelry starting at $200, plus Diamonds Direct's exceptional quality and unbeatable everyday price, you're sure to give her a gift that wows this generation and the next to come. Experience the thrill of jewelry shopping done right at Diamonds Direct. Diamonds Direct. Your love, our passion.
Finding the right news podcast can feel like dating. It seems promising until you start listening.
When you hit play on Post Reports, you'll get fascinating conversations and sometimes a little fun, too. I'm Martine Powers.
And I'm Elahe Azadi. Martine and I are the hosts of Post Reports. The show comes out every weekday from The Washington Post.
You can follow and listen to Post Reports wherever you get your podcasts. It'll be a match, I promise.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Tech Stuff, a production from iHeartRadio.
Hey there, and welcome to Tech Stuff. I'm your host, Jonathan Strickland. I'm an executive producer with iHeartRadio, and I love all things tech. And today we're going to listen to another classic episode of Tech Stuff. This one's titled Tech Stuff Watches Independence Day. It originally published on July 3rd, 2013, 7 years ago. Wow. So, as the name suggests, we sat down and watched Independence Day, and then we had a discussion about the technology in that film and, you know, how it stacks up against reality. Hope you guys enjoy. To start off, we should probably give an overview of the film for those of you who have not seen it. Now, this movie came out in 1996.
Right.
Now, in 1996, there were a few other things that were going on at that time. That's the year that DVDs launched in Japan.
Wow.
Yeah, so when I actually asked my friends if anyone had a copy of this, they all said they had it on VHS. And
we said, what's VHS? We don't even remember that medium.
I don't even know if I have anything that will still play a tape. There were other things that happened that year in the world of technology. Internet Explorer 3 launched. That was Microsoft's big browser. And, of course, the 3 was one of the bigger ones of the releases. Windows NT 4.0 was released by Microsoft as well. eBay got started. A little first-person shooter by the name of Duke Nukem 3D launched, and that ended up, of course, getting a lot of people really excited. They enjoyed the game. I include myself.
A sequel was planned.
Yes, a sequel was planned and would end up being vaporware for more than a decade. There was a certain animal that was born that year.
Yeah, Dolly the cloned sheep was born that
That's
year.
That's right.
First cloned mammal.
Yep, Dolly the sheep. First mammal successfully cloned. That's also the year that IBM's Deep Blue defeated the chess champion Garry Kasparov.
Yeah.
So man versus machine, and machine wins.
Yeah. It was also the Telecommunications Act of 1996, strangely enough, happened in 1996.
Yeah.
And that basically allowed the internet to sort of be lumped in along with broadband signals, and allowed cable companies to start offering internet services. People were really excited about this new megabit speeds that were going to start happening.
Right, right. We were finally getting away from the kilobit speeds that we were thinking of with the old dial-up modems. And, you know, this is back when the internet is pretty young as far as the general public is concerned. The internet itself had been around for a while, but really only research institutions, universities, some government facilities, military, that kind of stuff. Those organizations had access to it. But anyone outside of that really did not have a whole lot of access to the internet unless they just happened to work someplace or go to school someplace that had it. At this point in 96, we've actually got the point where the World Wide Web is a thing, but still very early on.
This was kind of the GeoCities era of the public internet.
Exactly, yeah. And according to thepeoplehistory.com, that they say that in the 12 months of 1996, the internet host computer number goes from about 1 million computers to 10 million computers. So obviously explosive growth at this time, although it's still very much a new thing, which kind of comes into play a little bit in the film Independence Day. So Independence Day, it was a movie by Dean Devlin and Roland Emmerich.
Those are the writers, yeah.
Yeah, and Emmerich is, of course, he's become known as the guy who likes to blow up the Earth. he's blown up the Earth in several movies and other projects, things like everything from Godzilla to 2012, The Day After Tomorrow. He's really big on worldwide destruction. And, of course, we should mention that not too long ago, it was announced that sequels to Independence Day had been planned, two sequels, with the first one coming out in like 2015, I think, or 2014. And Independence Day stars some folks that you might recognize, like Will Smith would be the big name.
Mm-hmm.
Bill Pullman, who I always get mixed up with Bill Paxton. If you put them side by side, I would not be able to name one versus the other, and I have a 50-50 shot.
You have this problem pretty commonly. Also Jeff Goldblum, who is very famous for being wacky scientist at the time due to Jurassic Park.
Right. He's also known as he does this stuttering thing where he.
I find that charming.
I do too. I enjoy it. Randy Quaid also in the movie as what you assume is a delusional drunk.
Mm-hmm.
Although apparently he's was
just
telling the truth. Yeah, he's not delusional. Adam Baldwin's in it.
Tiny, chibi Adam Baldwin. He's so young and adorable. It's very cute.
Yeah, it's definitely well before his Firefly days.
Yeah, Brent Spiner,
Data from Star Trek Next Generation. Mm-hmm. Although he does not play Data from Star Trek Next Generation in this movie, that would have been confusing. So to give a brief rundown on what the film's all about, in case you have not seen it, there are going to be a lot of spoilers in this podcast, but essentially, it's 96. I think it's safe to spoil it now.
Yeah, I think that statute of limitations.
So the movie is all about how this alien invasion force comes into Earth's orbit and then lays waste to the major cities on Earth in preparation for a full-on invasion. And it's about how Earth forces kind of mount up a desperate defense to fight off these alien invaders.
And this all happens, of course, from July 2nd to July 4th, which here in the United States is kind of a celebration of independence, and hence the term Independence Day.
Yeah.
And it's extremely, not ethnocentric.
Jingoistic.
Yeah.
it's all right, let me put it this way. It's about America. It's an American movie.
It is.
There's quite a bit of stuff about America, and then there's some token mentions of other places around the world where you see a brief scene in Iraq with British forces saying things like, "The Americans are on the case? Bloody hell." Like, that's, you know.
Jolly good.
Jolly
good. Pip,
pip. Pip, cheerio. And then it goes like to Japan and Russia. And of course, all the Russians are sitting around vodka and listening to the radio. And I mean, it's just, let's just say that the depiction of other cultures is somewhat stereotypical within the context of this movie.
Perhaps stilted. Yeah.
Don't worry though, everything is. So it's not just that we have a very, very American-centric film. No one comes out of this looking too great. But that's anyway, more commentary on the quality of the film. Let's get down to some of the science.
Yes. So, because this film is filled with science
and technology, and some of the stuff. There's one thing in particular.
There's a couple things that are really cool.
That end up being something that's similar to what we use today. And I'm actually really impressed. And it was a really cool idea that I don't know who came up with it, but it was a really nifty thing. But the movie opens with a shot of the moon. And you're actually looking at one of the moon landing sites, mm-hmm. where you see the footprints on the regolith on the moon.
And the placard.
Yeah, and the American flag. Mm-hmm. And then a shadow comes across the moon, and you hear this terrible rumbling noise.
Because in space, everyone can hear you scream.
Yeah, see, that's one of the things that happens in this film, is that sound does travel in space in this movie, which...
I can only assume that the ships themselves are mic'd.
That somehow they're pushing out an atmosphere where sound can actually travel.
Yes.
Because there's a rumbling on the moon, which technically you would not be able to hear unless you had your ear right up against the moon's surface, because there's not any atmosphere on the moon. So there's no way for particles to travel. Remember, sound is a physical manifestation. It's actually particles that are banging together. And if there's no atmosphere for the particles to bang together, you wouldn't be able to hear anything.
Speaking of which, there are really no, I mean, this ship kicks up all kinds of moon dust, mm-hmm. and shakes everything around a whole lot, which wouldn't really be...
Yeah, that wouldn't happen either, unless the propulsion system for the ship is somehow something like gravity-based,
sure.
Which is possible. That's something
it's
we should say.
It's alien tech. We'll give you that one.
Right, yeah. Alien technology, we don't know how it works, because we are not... we're not privy to that information, so it's quite possible that they're using some sort of gravity drive which somehow can affect actual particles. So we'll give them the rumbling. We'll give them at least the movement part. The rumbling part is a little...
Yeah, yeah. And we'll talk again about the ships in just a minute. I think we're kind of going in chronological order throughout the movie,
yeah.
because that's how we took our notes, strangely enough.
Exactly. And we should also say that lots of science fiction films have sound in space, and it's a dramatic...
Dramatic effect, yeah.
Yeah, you can't...
Although I do appreciate it when people don't do that.
Right, like Joss Whedon
like Firefly.
In Firefly,
yeah,
where you would have a ship explode and you don't hear anything because you wouldn't be able to. That makes sense, but I understand why they do it for dramatic effect. It would not be as effective for an audience. So I give them a pass on that, because they're using a common trope that's throughout all the science fiction films.
Sure.
We then get down to the surface of the planet... Where
SETI has suddenly realized, and it is pronounced
SETI.
SETI, right?
Yeah.
Not S-E-T-I, because one of the
SETI.
Characters in the film pronounces it
S-E-T-I. S-E-T-I,
and
yeah.
I was
no,
like,
but we just call it SETI.
Excellent. Cool.
It's the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. Now, this is a real organization, mm-hmm. and they use radio telescopes to search out radio signals from other places in the galaxy to see if there's anything broadcasting out there.
But by radio signals, we don't necessarily mean audio, like audible range.
Yeah, it might be
radio signals.
It might be, well, just like our Wi-Fi is a kind of radio transmission. It may be that it's just a series of frequencies that we pick up that end up looking like it's some form of communication. It wouldn't necessarily be like
beeps,
you know,
and boops and
or listening to 1950s rock or anything. You might be able to translate that into some sort of audible sound, but it wouldn't necessarily sound like anything.
Which is interesting to me, because in the SETI headquarters, they do have a scientist who goes like, I am hearing beeps and boops, literal audio beeps and boops
right.
coming through this headset, and that means something.
Right. So
clearly SETI in this little fractured universe has translated all of their radio frequencies into an audible signal
so that
technicians can...
And to be clear, SETI actually, you know, when they're looking for these radio signals, one of the things you have to keep in mind is there's a lot of stuff out there that can create a radio signal that isn't intelligent. It's just a natural phenomenon. It's
basically
like,
space creates radio signals.
Yeah,
I mean, objects within space, anything with gravity or with light.
You can have the potential for that. You can have anything like quasars, things like that, that create these radio signals. So what SETI has to do is not only look for the presence of radio signals, but then to
filter through.
Yeah, to make sure that that's some sort of meaningful communication as opposed to just random noise. Well, in this case, they figure out, hey,
there's something up there, and they see that there's a, through some form of thermal imaging, they see a gigantic spaceship. Now, later on in the movie, we discover that radar does not work on these spaceships. So radar, that's I guess, the excuse of why the spaceship was not detected until after it was right there at the moon.
Already, yeah, in Earth's orbit.
But thermal imaging works. So in other words, there's no cloaking device here. There's nothing that's keeping it invisible to us from our vision.
Sure.
Now, we can't get them by radar, but we could see them. Now, this ship, the mothership, because this is before it has let out any other smaller ships, is huge. According to the movie, it is 550 kilometers in diameter, which is about 342 miles. That's just under half the size of Texas at its widest point.
And it says that it's about a quarter of the mass of the moon. All of this meaning that
huge.
It's very, very big, and we would be able to see it, if not even without radar, with our naked eye. Like, looking up at the sky, we would go, oh, what?
Yeah, you'd at least be able to see the light from this thing, if nothing else. I mean, the sunlight reflecting off of it. But with telescopes, we'd be able to see it even further away.
Sure, and possibly, you know, maybe the shields, because it is revealed that the ship has some kind of shielding mechanism. Which blocks, you know, torpedoes.
Right.
But maybe it also blocks visual data.
I don't know. I mean, the question would be, why do they bother to reveal themselves at all? Because if it
dramatic effect. It's like a villain with a cloak.
That only makes sense within the context of a movie. When you step outside of that and you look at
it. No, come on. If you were going to destroy a planet, wouldn't you want to have a dramatic entrance?
I have learned my lesson. I am no longer revealing my egomaniacal plans to the hero before I set them in motion. Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me 478 times, shame on me. All right? Not again. 479, it's going down. Okay, but yeah, the it does not appear to be invisible. So that's one thing we can point out as being a problem, that we would have seen this thing coming toward the Earth,
even with no instrumentation. We would have literally
just with telescopes. Yeah, we would have seen it well before it ever reached as far as the moon. That being said, we also don't know if I assume the ship must have some sort of super fast propulsion system for deep space
travel.
Yeah, some
kind of faster than light, yeah.
Or at least, yeah. I mean, it would have to be, because there are no nearby systems that could support life from our position, right? There are no planets that are... Because we do learn that these aliens share a lot in common with us. They breathe oxygen.
Mm-hmm.
They have the same sort of tolerances for heat and cold, and so
they have some kind of visual cortex that allows them to use very similar computer displays to ours.
Yeah, that's a problem, but we'll get into that. But yeah, they have a lot of similarities to humans, which is already a huge coincidence. I mean, you know, there's nothing that says that another intelligent kind of life would have to be humanoid in shape.
That's one that I'm willing to give them, though. That's one. I mean, they're not quite, you know, it's not like Klingons versus humans, and so it's not quite that close,
but you still have, you know, general, you know, limbs and the head and
the
torso.
Universe is a very strange place, is all I'm saying. That's one that I'm willing to let slide.
Well, for them to be so similar to us and in multiple ways is a huge coincidence when you think about all the variables out there. I mean, when you really get down to it, when you talk about our sample size for planets with life on it, that's a one. As a sample size of one, we have one planet that we know of that supports life.
As we know it.
As we know it. So that's an incredibly small sample size. So, and this is a problem that's throughout science fiction. I'm not just picking on Independence Day.
Oh, sure.
But, you know, we have to extrapolate from what we know. So, I mean, I understand that. But for something to be this similar to us, it's pretty phenomenal. Anyway, the fact that they're this similar means that draws a lot of questions, one of which is that why are they coming here? And eventually it's revealed that they're planning on invading and taking over the planet, that what they do is they go from planet to planet, they consume.
Use up the resources and then move on to the next.
Yeah, they're like, well, this one's done, let's go on. Which then raises another question, which is that we assume there are a lot of exoplanets out there, lots of, we've already
found
lots of exoplanets. Yeah. There are several that we found that are what we within what we call the Goldilocks zone, which is this zone within a distance from the host star of that planet.
If we were in Star Trek, it would be called a Class M planet.
Yeah. Meaning that it would at least have the potential for supporting life as we know it, based upon its distance from the star. But that's all the, you know, and we might know something about the composition of the planet itself, but we wouldn't know enough about to say that whether there is or isn't life on it.
Sure.
However, I'm sure that just based upon the huge number we've already started to see in our, within our own galaxy, there must be countless planets that fall into this category, which makes you wonder, why would you bother going to, try and colonize one where the residents of that planet might fight back.
Well, I would argue that these aliens had to have been watching us long enough to understand our language and understand our computer language, which we'll get to in just a second, and furthermore understand our culture. Because when they do send out those little spaceships, they send them not to the most populated regions of the planet, but to the major cultural landmarks, as though they are specifically trying to evoke an emotional response in us.
As though
they are the creators of the film.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So if you're looking at it from a storyteller perspective, you want to park your spaceship directly over the Empire State Building or directly over the White House.
Or the Eiffel Tower, the Capitol building.
Yeah, exactly. You park it directly over some incredibly identifiable landmark because it's a great visual effect. If you are an alien, the reason you do it is, I don't know, you're already leveling cities. So we presume that they have some sort of faster than light drive in order for them to get to where they're going.
Right.
We don't know that. It's never revealed in the movie where they came from or how they got here. We don't know. They talk about how the radio signal is originating from the moon. I don't know how they figured that out. You could figure out it came from that direction.
The scientists at SETI say this radio signal is coming. Yes.
From the moon. But you don't, you could see what direction it was coming from if you were, triangulating from various radio stations and you saw how long it took to get to each one. You could figure out kind of where the origin point was.
Sure.
Distance is a little weird. Because radio signals can come from really far away. Now, granted, the strength of the signal would give you an idea, but that part
it's
I got
definitely
a little,
a, yeah, like
I stumbled
an,
over
an
it.
Equation that's a little bit on the fly.
They start using our own satellites to communicate, the aliens do. The mothership eventually has other ships split off from it. Oh, and one other thing I wanted to mention. You said that it had a quarter of the mass of the moon. In case you're curious, I did the math here. So the moon has a mass of 73 zettagrams, which would be if you wrote down the number 7 and then the number 3 and then put 21 zeros after it, that's how many grams of mass the moon has. So This spaceship has 1.8 zettagrams of mass, and they talk about the possibility of using an ICBM to bring this mothership down before it starts to split off and all the other ships come out from it. There's no nuclear weapon that could destroy that much mass. It just, we have not created a nuclear weapon that could do that much damage. Yeah, that's so massive. I mean, we don't, not only why would we, but how could we?
how do we know how much mass this thing has?
Yeah, I don't know.
Because they're
looking at it from a thermal imaging perspective, which really just tells you the size of it.
The way to measure that is a gravitational pull, and unless it is, unless they've calculated the amount that it's offset the tides,
even then you wouldn't be able to calculate, figure out what the mass is. That's a good question. I think the answer is they wanted to make sure it looked like it was big.
This is from my sheet of increasingly incredulous questions that I wrote.
Yes. How is this possible? Well, the mothership has all these large city-sized ships split off from it.
Right.
And the city-sized ships then come down and hover over the various cities, including directly over the Empire State Building, directly over the Capitol Building, directly over part of LA, et cetera, et cetera. And I think they say at one point it's 10 to 15 ships. So apparently they never get an accurate count. the ships are using our satellite system to communicate with each other.
Right.
They're bouncing signals off of our satellites, which raises a question. How do they get their technology to interact with ours?
They've clearly learned our computer programming languages.
They must have, because how else? And they must have then designed machines on their ships that could then interface with our machines, because otherwise you know, you can see that they're broadcasting radio signals, but on a technological level, you wouldn't be able to interact with that unless yours were somehow, had some sort of adapter, alien to Earth adapter, where you could tap into our technology. But they're using our satellite systems to send out a message, which Jeff Goldblum figures out.
He does. Well, because he's a really smart guy.
To be fair, though, this was one part of the movie that I found very plausible.
Right.
He discovers a repeating pattern that's being broadcast over radio signals. Now, you don't have to know what that translates to in order to notice that there is a pattern.
In order to notice that there is a pattern. And he notices that it's winding down
something.
Yeah,
it's reducing. Uh-huh. Each time it repeats, it reduces. So he then figures out that this
is a countdown.
Which is perfectly plausible.
Sure. No. That's great. Fine science.
That part, I was like, I am all right with this. This makes sense that you would have a repeating pattern that's getting slightly shorter each time. That sounds like a countdown.
Yeah. The issue that I've got here is that it shows a couple of our satellites crashing in to the mothership. Means that the mothership is significantly lower in orbit than the moon.
Right.
Or parts of it are anyway.
Yeah.
Secondly, just the way that they talk about satellites is not necessarily the way that satellites are talked about. Jeff Goldblum mentions transponder channels, which is like saying a pizza pie. Like it's kind of the same word over again.
It's really like it's essentially it's technobabble to try and sound like he's doing something effective. There's another thing that happens with the cable station in particular that just drove me crazy. Because I understand, again, that was done for effect.
For dramatic effect.
But it made no sense.
Right.
But we'll get into that in a little bit. So you've got all these spaceships splitting off. A satellite hits the spaceship, and there's no visible damage whatsoever. You also don't see the force field. But you don't see the force field at that point. You just see the satellite bang into the spaceship and then go boom.
Does it do a green boom or an explodey boom?
I think it's an explodey boom, I recall. Now, granted, I should add, this movie is 2 hours and 20 minutes long,
It's so long, guys.
Yeah, so we took turns watching and then taking breaks and then watching and then playing Borderlands 2 and then watching and then desperately trying to find something else to do and then watching. I watched this movie all the way through in the theater when it came out. I loved this movie as a teenager.
Sure.
We're going to take a quick break from watching Independence Day and then slagging on it to thank our sponsors.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
There's a lot happening these days, but I have just the thing to get you up to speed on what matters without taking too much of your time. The 7 from the Washington Post is a podcast that gives you the 7 most important and interesting stories, and we always try to save room for something fun. You get it all in about 7 minutes or less. I'm Hannah Jewell. I'll get you caught up with the 7 every weekday. So follow the 7 right now.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There is still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI. And Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI and revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
So, we then have the various people in American government reacting and trying to figure out what the heck is going on. The Secretary of Defense wants to blow it out of the sky with an ICBM, even though I've just said that...
that we do not have one that is that big.
Yeah, even though...
maybe it's a secret government program.
Now, the city-sized ships, once those split off, those could
those would
theoretically...
be
that I would... if you're talking about the size of a city, then
you
could
at least take it down.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe
you could do enough damage
completely.
To it. You could do enough damage to it where I seriously think it wouldn't be able to maintain flight. I mean, nuclear weapons are
depending
pretty
powerful. On your engine power source, which we
right.
still haven't
determined. And, yeah, we don't know.
Because
it.
These things are city sized and they are hovering noiselessly and effortlessly. Like they are not creating any kind of ripples in
right.
the space-time continuum as we know it
right.
so above these cities.
You've got this ship that's parked over your city, but it's not pushing
like a stealth
down.
Stealth plane just hanging.
Yeah, it's not pushing down in any way that would make you, like if you stepped outside, you wouldn't suddenly feel like some weird force pressing down on you.
Right. There's no breeze, there's no
yeah.
nothing.
So we don't know how they're hanging in the air like that.
Alien technology, I'll give it to him.
Yeah, it might as well be magic. So we don't know what's going on that case. We've got the whole Oval Office reaction. One of my favorite little moments in this is there's a point where a person brings in a silver briefcase to show the president something.
Oh, yeah, yeah, and opens it up, and there's like a little... it's not even a laptop. It's like
just a screen.
It's just a little screen.
Yeah, it's a screen with
a little 1996 iPad. I don't know.
Yeah, it's supposed to show a radar readout of the ships. I don't know why radar's working now. There's no explanation for why the radar readout works as opposed to... because half the time radar is not working, and the other half the time they talk about a radar readout. Don't know. Maybe it's just that the aliens keep forgetting to turn the stealth button on. Because these ships are not designed... like, if you've listened to our podcast about stealth technology, you know that a part of the way that stealth technology works is just based on the actual physical design of the vehicles. They have these weird angular designs to them. And
that makes stuff bounce off of them at awkward angles so that you can't receive the signals.
Exactly, exactly. But these ships are just gigantic flying saucers. So big flat surfaces that radar could easily bounce off of. They have to be able to absorb
shielding,
it.
Shielding, or if we're talking about those gravitational drives or something like that.
Lauren,
I don't know.
I never knew you were an alien apologist. but yeah, so don't know why the radar sometimes works and sometimes doesn't, but it's still kind of interesting here. There's also when the ships are moving into position over the cities, there's this weird sheath of fire that's all around them. And I was wondering if that was supposed to be the representation of these ships entering the Earth's atmosphere.
That's what I assumed.
But they don't seem to be moving very quickly. So it's almost like they have a very controlled descent into Earth's atmosphere. So they wouldn't, you know, the whole heat and fire stuff would only make sense if they were coming in at an incredible speed. And they're creating this amazing amount of pressure as they're coming in. And that's what builds up all this heat.
Maybe they have a fine magnesium powder that's operating their shielding system that's just lighting on fire as they... I don't know if that's a science fact.
Maybe
that
this
would
is
work
just
at all.
The equivalent of painting flames on your hot rod. This is wicked cool, guys. Let's turn the flames on. You know, that's what I'm thinking. Well, you know what? We got a lot more to say about this movie. But before we do, let's take a quick break to thank our sponsor, Audible. Audible.com is the leading provider of downloadable digital audiobooks and spoken word entertainment. Audible has over 100,000 titles to choose from to be downloaded to your iPod or MP3 player. Go to audiblepodcast.com/techstuff to get a free audiobook download of your choice when you sign up today. And since we're talking about science fiction today, one good suggestion would be War of the Worlds. They have several different versions at Audible, including one read by Orson frickin' Welles. So go check that out. Okay, so we've got the ships. They're over the various cities. We've got everyone's freaking out. No one knows exactly what's going on yet. Jeff Goldblum's discovered the signal. And he figures out that it's probably some sort of coordinated attack. This raises a question in my mind that's more of a plot question and less of a technology question, which is, I don't understand why the attack needs to be incredibly coordinated, because as is demonstrated throughout the film, these aliens have amazing technology that our technology just cannot stand up to.
Uh-huh.
Like, nothing we have puts a dent
in
what
they have. So it doesn't really matter if they're going to blow us up simultaneously or at a slight lag.
Right, right. Why?
Because they're still blowing us up.
Why even worry about targeting the largest cities first, unless it's just to get as many people dead as possible, which could just be an efficiency thing, in which case, all right, I can get that. They're trying to kill as many people in as little time as possible, because their ultimate goal is to invade the planet, and this way they'd wipe out, you know, the major centers of population.
They're clearly just Bond villains, really, at heart. They're doing it for dramatic effect.
Right.
They wanted to give one of our scientists something to latch on to.
Yeah, well,
in order to make us feel like we have a fighting chance.
I think the wiping out as many people as possible is as much sense as I can make of it. But it, I mean, it does make sense in a way. If you're talking about clearing out an area so that you can then come in and reap all the benefits.
Sure.
Then I understand, like, all right, well, you want to do that, you need to hit before everyone realizes what's up, because then they're just going to scatter like cockroaches, and then you have to hunt them all down and squish them.
Yeah, yeah. This is also about when our satellites, like all of our satellite communications, start kind of breaking up a little bit in this weird static pattern, which I'm not sure is how satellites work.
No, if satellites were, they say
if some were being destroyed and some of the capacity of the satellite was being used to transmit this alien signal, I think that the signal would just go out. I don't think it would be static.
Anything that was destroyed, obviously the signal would go out. Having this idea of an alien signal underlying our own signals is interesting. Depending upon the bandwidth of the satellite, I could actually see it working in a way where it means that our signals are actually weaker, but I don't think it would come across exactly the way it did in the movie.
Sure.
There's one point, Jeff Goldblum's character, the brilliant scientist guy who's now essentially just working for a cable provider, there's one point where he's talking with his comedic sidekick character, who is later on obliterated, spoiler alert, Harvey Firestein, where he's chatting with him, and then suddenly a White House announcement comes on the screens.
And this wall of screens that had previously been picking up broadcasts from all different channels.
Yeah, yeah. So you think of just a wall of television screens, and each television screen is showing a different channel, and now they're all showing the White House thing, but some of them, like groups of 9 screens, become one big display. So, you know, you're
as though they're the Power Rangers or something, and they're all just building up together.
I think of Voltron.
Voltron, but, sorry. Right. That's era.
But no, yeah, this idea that, you know, if you have a block of 9 screens, the upper left screen is the upper left corner of the full picture. How does that happen? Like, how would you...
Voltron.
Would that mean, like, Channel 32 is only showing the upper left corner of a White House thing?
The alien disruption in our communication signal is causing our televisions to start acting like Voltron.
And I completely dismiss your apologetic response. Yeah, this is one of those things where I just thought it was ridiculous, where you have all these disconnected screens suddenly showing a unified display. It just, I mean, it was clearly there for dramatic effect, but it doesn't make any sense. The only way that works is if you have pre-recorded it and programmed out the screens to show exactly what you want when you want it. It doesn't happen over a live broadcast where suddenly 9 screens gain sentience and all work together to bring together the president's words.
Yeah.
The Jeff Goldblum decides he has to go to D.C. to find his ex-wife, who now works at the White House.
And also marginally help save the planet.
Right. So, yeah, that's in the process. So he goes with his dad, and he and his dad go down to D.C. because Jeff Goldblum's character doesn't drive a car. So he rides with his dad, who does, who drives very slowly, to comedic effect. And they arrive at D.C. And then he quote, triangulates the position of his wife through her cell phone use, which is
cell phones in this period were Fox Mulder's cell phone. Yeah. I mean, they were bricks.
They were rare, too. Not everyone had them. But yeah. But triangulating is probably not the right word here. You could triangulate someone's position using someone who's using a cell phone. You could triangulate it, particularly if you're the cell phone company. But more likely what he was doing was
At the time, didn't they kind of purposefully scramble a lot of that? Or couldn't you not really use GPS?
GPS. That's not even a thing.
Okay.
I mean, GPS is a thing, but not on any civilian cell phone.
Personal level.
Not
sure.
In 1996. So you could do it just by the cell phone signal. You know, the cell phone's sending out radio signals from the phone because she's on the phone at the time. And the idea is that what he's doing is detecting the radio signal from her phone and then figuring out where she is within the context of the White House. He couldn't really triangulate. I mean, to triangulate, you need 3 points. That's kind of the whole idea of triangulation. You need these 3 sides, and you have to be able to know the different angles between you and a couple. You need to know at least the distance between you and one other point, and at least the measurement of 2 angles for you to be able to determine the position of whatever it is you're looking for.
Yeah.
And he obviously doesn't have all that information. What he was really doing was a kind of localization through multilateral radio signals, which is possible, but is not terribly precise. So in other words, he'd be able to say, she's in the White House, which they already knew. But anyway, again, movie logic. We have the whole bit of where the ships actually start to unleash their attack. So at this point, our various heroes have all started to make their way out of the cities. Otherwise, the movie's over really quickly.
Dead and, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the spaceships start to beam down energy into the cities to wipe them out. We don't know what kind of energy
it is. It's some kind of energy weapon. It's kind of a green glowing laser stuff that moves slower than light speed.
Right. So it's kind of like our podcast about plasma weapons.
Sure.
You know, it's similar to that. But we figure, all right, so the slowing down, obviously, that's for again, dramatic effect. Because if it was going at light speed, it would just be boo, and you're like, wow. this was more, you know, intimidating and frightening. But so let's just assume it's some form of laser. There could even be plasmification going on, because if the laser is powerful enough, it could actually plasmify
the atmosphere.
Yeah, the atmosphere around the laser. And then you see this explosion from the focal point moving outward. And it just keeps rolling out.
Like a ripple effect, like a pond.
Yeah, exactly. Like if you were to throw a rock into a pond and you watch those ripples, that's exactly what this looks like, except it's just the one ripple, right? It's not like a sequence of them.
Sure.
So you see this one ripple moving outward of explosiveness, and it never seems to disperse until it gets to like the edge of the city. It just keeps going outward, which the blast only happens once. Like it shoots down once at whatever monument it happens to be parked over, because we've already established that's what they do.
That's what they do.
The aliens are kind
that's
of
how they roll.
They're kind of jerks. They're a bunch of jerk faces. Not only are they destroying our cities, but they have to first hit whatever iconic building or structure is there. They're like, not only are we going to kill you, we're going to blow up your stuff. Like the stuff you like.
The stuff you like.
The stuff that's on your postcards. That's what we're blowing up. Because it makes really good movie posters.
They've been watching our communication signals.
Yeah, they probably actually had already seen Emmerich's future films before he had even made them, and they said, that's a good idea. So, because, I mean, if they're going faster than light, that means they've got some time travel stuff going on, too. Anyway, this explosion that moves outward, there's the scientific problem I have with this is that the energy doesn't seem to disperse. Like they shoot the blast down once, and then the blast turns off, and then you just see the spreading explosion, and it never seems to be losing energy. But in order for this to really work, they'd have to constantly be pouring energy into it, because, you know, otherwise it would just disperse outward. Heat does not stay in a ripple effect.
Maybe only that initial blast is within the visible spectrum, and the rest is using some of that graviton technology that they clearly have to create some kind of like magnetic gravitational ring. That
so they're
expands
using
out.
You know what? If you're talking about plasma, that works. I will grant you that, because plasma will respond to magnetic fields. So, okay, I retract my objection. If that's possibly what happened, then that's fine. So I did some math here where I was trying to determine how many people would have theoretically died as a result of these attacks.
Right.
So assuming that the ships were able to hit most of the major cities in the world, and really at first they're hitting like 10 or 15 of them, and then they move on to hit smaller cities like Atlanta. Atlanta's in round two, so we don't get off scot-free in this one. So in 1996, the world had approximately 5.8 billion people. We've got quite a few more since then. But 5.8 billion people in 1996. So I assumed that about 40% of the world's population were in cities. Now, that's a rough assumption. In 1950, it was around 30%. And I think it was 2008 when we finally hit 50% population in urban environments. So between 1950 and 2008, I'm saying 40%. So 40% of the world's population in cities, that's about 2.3 billion people total. And then I made a further assumption. I said, all right, a lot of people tried to evacuate. So let's say that 50% of them got out of the city and they're safe, and the other 50% are still within the city when these attacks happen. That means that you've got about 1.16 billion people left behind
in
those cities. So then I said, all right, let's assume a 70% fatality rate, meaning that 30% of the population is able to find some place where they're able to hunker down and survive.
They're in a bomb shelter or a
helpful alleyway if you happen to be Will Smith's love interest. Thank goodness the dog lives. By the way, this movie, not so subtle with its emotional manipulation. They use everything. Children, they use dogs, they use the wonderful trope of character who has been terribly injured, but not so badly that they can't have that one last tender
conversation.
Moment.
Yeah. Thank you, President Laura.
Oh, man. That's the scene I hate the most in this movie, and that's saying something. But anyway, with a 70% fatality rate, I figure that about 812 million people die as a result of this attack. So that's a conservative estimate. Then we've got the thing about the alien shields, which we assume are probably some form of magnetic or maybe even gravity drive. We don't really know that. We don't know about what the energy weapons really are.
Right, right.
All right, so that brings us to this whole idea of the Roswell / Area 51 part of the movie.
Right, because what happens is all the cities start being blowed up, and and the president and a bunch of other military persona head off to Area 51.
Yeah, after
where the secret base is located underground.
Right, Jeff Goldblum's dad says, "Hey, you guys, you knew about this ever since the thing in Roswell, and then you hit it in Area 51." And the president says, "No. That's just a rumor. It's urban legend. It's not real.
Anything.
And then the Secretary of Defense is like, well, actually.
Cut to.
Yeah, but here's the thing. First of all, the president in this sequence appears to be unaware of the actual existence of Area 51.
Which is an actual base.
It's an actual base. Although the military didn't really refer to it as Area 51 beyond some designations on a map. And the reason it was called Area 51 is because of its proximity to a nuclear testing range, where they had divided up the range into different areas. It was more known as Groom Lake, which was a dry lake bed in Nevada. And it really is a real place, but it was used to test experimental and secret aircraft.
Right.
So things like spy planes that were being tested by the Air Force that was the testing ground. And it was meant to be this secret area so that they could do this test without revealing to the world, hey, this is what we're working on. But it doesn't actually have any connection to Roswell. And in fact, Roswell, New Mexico, and Groom Lake, Nevada, are not close to each other.
Although there are theorists who have said that that any potential crash landings at Roswell were brought to a secret underground base at Area 51.
Right, essentially shipped across state lines to go to this secret underground base. But the Roswell event, by the way, in case you're not familiar with that, This is an event that happened in the, I think it was in the 50s, where a resident of New Mexico.
1947,
thank you. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a little earlier than I was thinking. So in 1947, a resident of essentially Roswell, New Mexico, came across this weird stuff. It was this shiny stuff that had was in a little pile on the ground. And for a while, people were assuming that it was some form of UFO from outer space that had crash-landed on the Earth. Later on, much later on, the military said that what this was part of Operation Mogul, which was a spy balloon initiative. It was testing out using balloons as spy vehicles to get information and radio it back to some other place. And there are plenty of conspiracy theorists who don't accept that, who'd say that that's not the right answer. Although, you know, the military for a while was very much quiet about what this actually was. But then it was because it was a spy program. So you don't really want to let everyone know.
Yeah, it was during the Cold War. You know, people were trying to keep things under wraps. So
yeah. Yeah. You know, we've seen in recent events how people don't want spy information to get out to the general public. But that's an entirely different podcast that we do plan on recording.
Yes.
But we want to have enough time to be able to really cover that in great detail. If you don't know what I'm talking about, just look up NSA and PRISM, and that'll be this little preview for a future episode of Tech Stuff. Anyway, in this film, they take the assumption that the space ship crash in Roswell was, in fact, an alien spaceship. It was not some balloon.
It was, in fact, one of these aliens,
yes,
spaceships.
And it was, there are three levels of spaceship in Independence Day. There is the mothership, which is the 550-kilometer diameter ship.
Hanging out by the moon-ish.
Yep. There are the city-sized ships that hover directly over a city, thus making it easy to tell how big they are, because you just look at it and say, that's the size of the city. Not terribly precise, but, you know, gets the point across. Then you have the fighter ships. These are like the tiny little ones that are kind of a similar to jet fighters here on Earth. That's kind of their purpose, at least in the film. That's what it seems to be. So it was one of those smaller ones that had apparently crashed in Roswell, and then they move the ship and its inhabitants, who two of whom are dead and the third one who dies a few days later, back over to Area 51 in Nevada. Underground. So the president is alerted that, in fact, all of this stuff actually did happen.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, well, why wasn't I told? And they say plausible deniability, so that if anyone asked you, you would honestly say that it doesn't exist, because as far as you know, it doesn't.
Although, to be fair, the way that security clearances work, just because someone has the highest possible security clearance, compartmentalized.
Yes, it is very much compartmentalized. So just because someone has got the highest levels of security clearance doesn't mean that they actually have all the information.
Right.
You still have to go through all the different channels to get it. Anyway, so they go to Area 51, where they find a state-of-the-art scientific lab where people are top men, are working on on determining what
AKA
the heck...
Nerds, a.k.a. Brent Spiner.
Brent Spiner, with yeah. long gray hair and glasses. And coming across as like the typical science geek character.
Yeah.
With no or limited social skills.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So anyway, he shows off the ship, which they said has suddenly become active once the other ships have come into the proximity of Earth.
And that's actually really cool.
Yeah.
This concept of the ships having some kind of
mesh network.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. This is one of those things where I think Independence Day really got it right, to the point where this is a really cool idea. It's this idea of this entire force, this spaceship force, that is working on some form of what I presume is radio frequency, where that's they are communicating all with each other so that there can be a truly coordinated effort on the part of the entire force. So this includes everything from power to communications. So when the fleet gets within the right range of Earth, this ship starts to react. And we have mesh networks now. Back in 1996, we really didn't have mesh networks the way we do now. But now we've got networks where you can have elements of that network join and drop out spontaneously throughout an entire, you know, period of time, whatever that period of time you want to be. Like, You can think of a mesh network from everything from a personal sized mesh network. So you're talking about like Bluetooth devices that can seamlessly link in and link out of it to citywide mesh networks if you really wanted to. We talk about smart cars and this idea of a smart grid where the cars can kind of maneuver through a city autonomously.
Mm-hmm.
That's essentially a mesh network where every single car is a part of it. So this is actually an idea that I thought was ahead of its time and made sense.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, kudos to them for coming up with this because it really was a cool idea that we're actually seeing put into place in a different implementation, obviously. We haven't invaded any alien planets as far as I'm aware, but we have started to use this kind of approach.
Right, right, yeah. Although while we're on the topic of grids, I did want to kind of point out that no one ever really talks about the fact that if you destroy this many major metropolitan areas, that the electrical grid would probably be not
toast.
Not good.
Yeah, no, that is true. We don't know where everyone's getting their power at
yeah,
this point.
Yeah, and you can assume that Area 51 would have its own generators. But
right, right, right. Yeah, and some of these army bases, I suppose, have access to power from other places. I mean, most of these military bases, I suspect, do not have their own power generating facilities.
We'll be right back talking more about Independence Day, but first let's take another quick break.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
There's a lot happening these days, but I have just the thing to get you up to speed on what matters without taking too much of your time. The 7 from the Washington Post is a podcast that gives you the 7 most important and interesting stories, and we always try to save room for something fun. You get it all in about 7 minutes or less. I'm Hannah Jewell. I'll get you caught up with the 7 every weekday. So follow the 7 right now.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There is still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
We also know that global communications are down, so they get around that by using telegraph wires.
Uh-huh. Morse code.
And they use Morse code. I assume they're using Morse code simply because the telegraph wires are the most reliable means of communicating rather than some way of masking the communication from aliens.
Oh, it seems like a little bit of both, which confuses me on A, you're still conveying information electrically and transcontinentally is a really long... I mean, I don't know. I find it implausible that that wire would have survived.
It's, well, if it's all underwater, if it's under the ocean, then it is possible that the that at least some of the telegraph wires have managed to survive. Like, at least some communication lines have survived. The transatlantic lines. Actually, anything that is under the ocean, I have no problem believing that that survived. Whether it survived enough nodes so that you could have a dedicated connection. But that's one of the good things about the internet. And it's something that I think we easily look over. It's the idea that the way that the transmission protocols were designed for the internet means that if you were to lose a large part of the internet, information could still pass through
reroutes.
The worst. Yeah. Cause it can dynamically route across different networks. Now, telegraphs, that's different, right? That's not divided up into packets of information like an email is. It's sent as a direct signal. But I assume that they weren't really trying to mask their communications. But if they were, Morse code's not that
difficult to crack.
Yeah, it's just a code. All it is replacing letters with particular dash and dot combination.
And certainly, so, if these aliens can crack our satellite communication systems, then
they could definitely
easily
crack Morse code, especially if they've had any contact with humans where they understand the concept, because they do give you that feeling that whenever an alien makes telepathic contact with a human, which we see in this Area 51 scene, Brent Spiner, he gets his brain all taken over, and the mm-hmm. president does too, briefly, by a telepathic alien, that knowledge is shared. That the person who has the telepathic communication with the alien learns things about the alien's brain, and the alien learns things about the human's brain. So just that alone, I mean, even if the person that they control doesn't understand Morse code, like they don't know Morse code, they would probably at least have heard what Morse code is.
Right.
Which means the aliens would be like, all right, this is a code where they've replaced letters with this. I know what the letters are. Let's just figure this out. And it wouldn't take you long at all. I mean, once you know the basic rules of language, decoding something that's a simple replacement cipher, very easy. So that's why I'm saying I don't think it was meant to mask the communication so much as just be a way of people communicating across vast distances once the other lines had been cut.
I'm wondering right now how the psychic communication part happens, which is straying a little bit from technology, I understand.
No, it's science, though.
It is science, and that's, you know, because if you can communicate more or less telepathically, and I'm assuming electrically, due to the way that that these aliens' brains seem to have an effect on memory, muscle systems, and furthermore, electrical systems in the nearby area. It's almost like they send out kind of an EMP a couple of times.
Yeah.
And,
Well, you would think that anything that would require manipulation of thought would have to work on an electrical basis, at least at some point, because when you get down to the cellular level.
Well, and also Brent Spiner talks.
Yeah.
From the alien's point of view. So it's.
He becomes a data puppet.
Yeah.
You're actually making puppet motions with your hands.
I am. No. It made perfect sense. And at that point, it's your muscular systems are electrical.
There's no explanation of how this telepathic
why they need to use our satellites if they're telepathic.
Right. Yeah. If they are telepathic, unless it's the telepathy only works over short distances, but this is
those
all
those gravity drives must get in the way.
Yeah, exactly.
Of the telepathic signals.
Like, all right, guys, get any communication you want out of the way now because we're about to start moving and you know, there's no talking once we get moving. Cause they don't have any mouths. They cannot speak, but they do communicate telepathically. We don't understand much of that, but then the movie is told from the point of view of the human protagonists.
Of course.
And the humans are at a disadvantage because they know very little in general about the aliens. So I'm even willing to give them a bit of a pass on this, saying that the alien physiology and the telepathy are...
It's just beyond our understanding.
It's beyond our understanding.
Okay.
And we call it telepathy because we don't have a word. For whatever it is they're using.
No, that's all right.
But I agree with you. And also, assuming that there's going to be any kind of compatibility between alien physiology and human physiology where this telepathy would work across species is a huge leap. I mean, you know, these are two species that don't have any connection to one another at all biologically, as far as we know. So the ability for telepathy to work across species is a pretty big jump.
I just had the earnest, I apologize for this, I just had the earnest thought, well, it worked really well in Slither.
Moving forward, biomechanical suits. So these aliens are actually, the when you first see them, they're these big, giant, nasty-looking critters. But it turns out that the big, giant, nasty-looking critter is actually a shell for a smaller, nasty-looking critter inside of it. And that the shell is a biomechanical suit. This is another thing I thought was really super cool.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, we've got a lot of work in exoskeletons here today on Earth. Now, these exoskeletons are mechanical and electronic. They're not biomechanical.
Right.
But then we're also seeing things like robotic limbs that are designed to mimic the way our biological limb would work. And that's really awesome. Again, still it's mechanical. It's not biomechanical. But we're slowly moving toward what could possibly be a biomechanical future where perhaps someone who has to have a limb amputated receives something that's more akin to a biomechanical arm as opposed to just a mechanical one,
right.
or electronic one. So I thought that was really neat. I did think that the design was weird, specifically the feet.
Yeah, they have these tentacles that are kind of curled under like sloth toes, and
I think they look like they are like they're rigid to me. So to me, they look like not like tentacles, but like these toes that are curled around.
I think that was a limitation of the puppet that was being used,
okay.
The practical effect.
So you
and
think that it was supposed
I think
to
that it was supposed to be the same wiggly tentacle that we saw being wiggly in Pneumatic earlier.
Also,
I'm so sad
that you guys can't see this because when Lauren demonstrates wiggly tentacles, she's looking a bit like a frantic Muppet.
To be fair, I usually look a bit like a frantic Muppet, I think.
Yeah, but, we'll have to shoot the video version of this podcast at some point so we can see the tentacle. We'll both do our own version.
Google Glass is coming. It's going to happen.
That is. Google Glass is coming. I'll be getting my pair in a couple of days. Yeah, but anyway, I just thought that the feet were weird. But if they were supposed to be tentacles that are actually flexible, that makes more sense to me. But if they were supposed to be these rigid, weird, curled, backward toe things, that's not the best foundation for your bipedal suit.
Maybe on their planet the gravity is different, so it's like that C.S. Lewis novel where
maybe they just all hang upside down from trees and they have to hook their toes onto the tree limbs in order to be able to move, and
clearly.
So they're not normally walking on ground. I don't know. So then the next note I have actually involves a plot point.
A plot point.
Yeah, not just the science.
We had those.
Yeah. Yes, the movie does have a plot. But the president's wife is injured in a helicopter crash.
The president's wife, of course, being played by President Laura from Battlestar Galactica.
Right. So the president's wife is injured critically, but
inspecifically.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very vague. There's internal bleeding. That's all we know. She's suffered the internal bleeding injury. And the duration of which is it will let her live just long enough for her to have that tender moment.
Poignant conversation.
Yeah,
with
her husband just before passing away. And then, of course, you get the little daughter saying, is mommy sleeping? And the president saying, yes, she is. And then the sad moment. Like, again, not a subtle movie is Independence Day. They like to take emotion and whack you right upside the head with it in a very clumsy, ham-fisted manner. Kind of similar to the way that they depict America. And all of the world. Like, it's just it's a very simple, simple representation of emotion and politics. Now we get into the part of the movie that everyone remembers. Whenever anyone has a discussion about Independence Day and science and technology, this is the part that everyone brings up.
Right, because the entire plot hinges upon Jeff Goldblum's characters. We keep saying Jeff Goldblum as though he was actually there. I was not paying that much attention, I have to say. His concept is, okay, so we can't destroy these ships because they're shielded.
Yeah.
But I can program a virus on my Mac.
Yeah.
And if we can get that virus into the ships, then we can take down the shields and then blow the ships up.
Yeah, now this is just mostly due to a gross misunderstanding of what exactly a computer virus is. So in this movie,
I think they were using a word that it's you keep using that word. I don't know
if it means what you think it means. Yeah, if we did an episode about Princess Bride, it'd be much shorter, but it would just be us quoting is all it would be.
You can do that with your friends.
I do it with my friends all the time. But yeah, the in this film, a computer virus is essentially saying this will turn the shields off. That's all this computer virus does. So it's really more like a command, sending a command to like the shield thing, switch that to the off position and keep it off for as long as you possibly can. But they call it a computer virus. Now, typically computer viruses do one of a few things. Your very basic computer worm, the old style computer virus that was really just meant to cause as much mischief as possible, was a self-replicating piece of code that if you were to execute it would start to copy itself and to whatever medium you were using. So like a hard drive. So it would copy itself to your hard drive, filling up your hard drive space and making your computer essentially unusable. Also your computer's memory. So it just kind of bricks your computer. Mm-hmm. Then there were the kinds that would try to wipe all the data off, you know, just essentially reformat your computer. Then there were the kinds that were designed to take advantage of a vulnerability in whatever operating system you were using so that someone could get access to your machine, administrative level access to your machine.
Yeah, either lock you out and grant someone else access or simply grant someone else access.
Right, yeah. So the whole backdoor access thing where you can get access to another person's machine, you might not lock them out at all so that they seem to think that everything's working fine. They don't, to them, it doesn't seem to be any different. It might be
it's
a little slower.
Invisible parasite kind of issue.
But then someone else is running the game and trying to use your computer to do various things. So those are your basic types of malware. I mean, there are other kinds as well. There are phishing scams, things that do key logging to try and figure out what it is that you're typing. But that's kind of the basics for computer viruses. They're not necessarily something that, you know, does very specific functions. So here are the multiple problems I have here.
Okay.
One is that you have an alien computer system and a human computer system that are at all compatible. Just as biology being compatible is really implausible, computer systems is incredibly implausible.
And again, I'm almost willing to give them a pass on the aliens studying us enough to have figured out our satellite communication systems. Because, you know, I don't know how long they've been studying us. That's sure. And they're aliens. That's fine.
But, yeah, but at least since 1947, right?
But if you're just watching Jeff Goldblum. If it's just one dude over the course of like a day.
Yeah. And the idea, even if they've been studying the alien technology aboard this ship, I doubt that they had had any luck in, clearly they said that the ship had not been operational at all until a couple of days, like since
the
invasion
mothership
had
came
started.
Back in. Right.
Right. So they didn't have any access to the computer system there. There's no reason their computer systems would run on the same sort of binary system that we use. Now, the fact that our system uses this particular form of computer science is because that's what was working for us. But there's no guarantee that any other society would develop computers the same way we did. So there's no, and even if they did, there's no guarantee that there would be an easy way to interface one system with another. How do you connect an Earth-based computer so that you can actually send a virus to an alien technology? This is
1996. They didn't even have Bluetooth. So, yeah. You know, yeah.
They're not like, you know, it appears that you just have to get close enough and you can magically do it, but which would be like Bluetooth, but I don't know. I don't, you know, there's no explanation for that. It's simply, this is a plot device meant to let the heroes have their chance at overcoming
and doing the stuff
odds. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And I understand it from a story beat perspective. Like, this is what we need to do in order for there to be this heroic moment. I completely get that. From an actual computer science perspective, it makes no sense. There are some people who say, wow, it makes no sense that he's using a Mac. I want to address that very quickly. So we think of Macs as being largely virus proof. Not so much as today, as much as we used to, but I would argue that the reason why Macs were less likely to fall victim to viruses is due to two things. One, Apple does lock its system down really tightly.
Sure.
So that does help. I mean, the fact that it's so locked down meant that it was not as accessible to people who wanted to write code
right.
that could take advantage of it.
Yeah, yeah. It was more difficult, but also there were fewer Mac users for a very long time.
Exactly, Lauren. That is the key. Right. There are fewer Macs when you look at.
And so if you're trying to cause havoc, then really your best bang for your buck is to go after Windows
PCs.
Systems.
Yeah. You want to go after.
PCs because you certainly can't rule out alternate OSs.
Although, I mean, Windows really was the thing you aimed for, because Windows had the majority of the share. So you want to go for a target-rich environment. Now, you could say that Windows was more had more vulnerabilities than Apple systems, which I'm not going to argue that. I think that's true. But it's not that the Mac was immune to viruses. It's that it had a lot working for it to prevent people from even trying to write viruses.
From even bothering.
Yeah, because if they're like, well, I could try and write a virus for Mac and it might work, but I'm going to hit 5% of the computer population when I could aim for 90%, which is going to get bigger results for me. I might as well focus on that. Anyway, I don't have a problem with the fact that he's using a Mac to design this code. My problem is it shouldn't work anyway. Whether it's a Mac or a PC or a Linux machine, Unix, doesn't matter, because you're talking about an alien computer system and a human computer system. So it doesn't matter which operating system you're using. But anyway, that's his idea, and he shows it off in Area 51. He's able to turn the shields off and activate the ship's flight controls. Because apparently, once you're able to connect your computer to the alien computer, you know what everything does. Like, think about all the systems that would be required to make an alien ship work, especially considering the fact that Jeff Goldblum's character, David... It is David.
Because
when he boots up his laptop, they
They have the 2001 reference.
Yeah, the 2001 reference of Dave, you know. Good morning, Dave.
Good morning, Dave.
Yeah. Don't reference better movies in your movies, people. Just reference worse movies. Granted, it's hard to guess which movies are worse until you're done. But, you know, aim for really bad ones, because then the odds are in your favor. Anyway... there's the 2001 reference, Good Morning Dave. So he's David, and Steve is Will Smith's character. So,
okay.
So Steve and Dave get into their alien ship and blast off to go after the mothership, right? Well, think of all the systems that are required to make that work. You have to have the propulsion systems, the flight systems. You have to have the life support systems. Thank goodness these aliens breathe oxygen.
Right, because they're going to space. I mean, also just from a piloting standpoint, Will Smith's character just gets in there and kind of does it. And
yeah, because he's seen how they fly. So like, as in he's
watched the ships go.
Yeah, he's seen how they move through an atmosphere. Therefore, he knows how they fly.
And in space too, because he's not space trained.
Now, people, I've seen jets fly. I could not fly a jet. I've seen helicopters fly. I could not fly a helicopter. Just because I've seen how they move through a certain area doesn't mean I can fly them.
Well, I mean, you know, he is a trained fighter pilot. Maybe a more apt description would be, you know, I've seen people drive Mack trucks, but I don't know how to drive a diesel truck.
Okay, how about this? I have piloted a ship that was a sailing ship. I have never driven a motorboat. But okay. Both of them do move through the water. The propulsion systems are totally different.
Okay.
But that's what I'm saying, is that being an expert on one does not mean that you're an expert on the other. However, for the purposes of dramatic effect, let's let it go. We're giving this movie a lot of passes right now. Also, we know that this episode's gone on really long. But so we've got that. That's the big one that everyone points out, is this computer virus that is designed to turn off the shields. And of course, their goal is they have to get aboard the mothership in order for this to work. There's no way for them to beam the code directly to the mothership. They never explain how it is that by just getting into the proximity of the ship, they're able to get the code into the mothership. They don't explain that. So apparently proximity is necessary, but we don't know why. Like, why do you have
Maybe
to be in the ship?
Maybe he plugs the Mac into a magnetic port within the ship, and then through the magnetic docking mechanism?
That's it. Clearly, they get aboard the alien ship and like, oh, sweet, it's got Firewire. We're good to go. Man, we would have been so boned if we hadn't had Firewire in here.
That's obviously it.
And
also, like all other programmers and hackers from the 1990s, he uses a animated skull.
Yeah, the Jolly Roger.
The Jolly Roger.
As the symbol of the virus.
Uh-huh, sure.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
it's
that
important.
Makes sense. It has to. You have to do that. And of course, they deliver a nuclear bomb that has a 30-second timer on it to destroy the mothership and then get out. There's no explanation as to why they picked 30 seconds, other than the fact, again, dramatic
effect.
The idea being that this gives the heroes an even tougher challenge to escape the blast radius of a nuclear bomb before they are affected by it.
And I haven't personally done the math on how fast you would have to fly in order to outfly an explosion, but I'm almost, I mean, it's at least not outrunning an explosion, so I'm kind of...
Yeah, it's a little better. It's a little better than having to outrun an explosion. Now, there's plenty of outrunning explosions in this movie, too, especially in the parts where the cities are being destroyed. But
FYI, folks, don't try not to ever put yourself in a position where you need to outrun an explosion, because you would die.
Yeah. Explosions move faster than you can run.
Yes.
Even you, Usain Bolt. Don't try it. So, we're getting toward the end of the movie here. So we got the explosion of the mothership, which is really odd. You pointed this out too, Lauren, that the explosion for the mothership has this weird kind of disc explosion.
Yeah.
Like it doesn't explode out in all directions. It explodes
out. The way
that
would in space.
Yeah, it explodes out in a plane. Like a plane as in a horizontal plane. It's like, you think of a plate that's been smashed into 1,000 pieces and there's just spreads apart, like in a horizontal plane. It doesn't go out in all directions.
Alien explosions.
Yeah.
They're different.
Maybe it's just because the way the ship was built, that it's just really, really secure on the top and bottom. But the outer edge is just paper mache. Just paper mache. We don't know what it is that really causes the massive explosion within the ship itself. I mean, apart from a nuclear bomb going off. But again, one nuclear bomb would not be enough to destroy a ship of that mass.
Maybe they found the gas tank.
Yeah. We're thinking like maybe there's fusion coils or something that were affected and that created some sort of, you know, I don't know. Maybe the nuclear bomb actually fell down a ventilation shaft that led directly to the reactor core. And then Alderaan, I might be thinking of a different movie.
I think you are.
Okay. And then the very end of the movie has Steve and Dave, who, you know, you don't know if they've survived, but surprise, they did. And they're walking down the desert and they're greeted by their respective women folk. And they are
and children folk.
And children folk. And they are embraced and everyone's happy. And then Steve, Will Smith's character, leans down to his the little boy that would be his adopted son, essentially, or his stepson, should he? Well, I guess he is a stepson now because I forgot.
Because they got married.
They got married
they totally
in the movie.
Because
you have to have that yet another emotionally manipulative moment. So his stepson, he says to his stepson, "Didn't I promise you fireworks?" And I thought, and only 812 million people had to die for those fireworks to happen. And scene. There's so much more in this movie. There's the part where David, the Jeff Goldblum character, is riding to Washington, D.C. with his dad, and he opens up his laptop to pull up a...
While in the car. In 1996, when Wi-Fi essentially does not exist.
Yeah, he's not... I seriously doubt that he was using any kind of really primitive cellular data network to pull this information, especially since it was represented by graphics. It must have been stored
locally
on the computer. But he pulls up all phone books in the United States in order to find his ex-wife's phone number. And I just thought it was funny they didn't just have the phone number written down. This was obviously another one of those moments designed to show you that this guy is good with computers.
He knows the computers.
Yes. Computers and this guy are good friends.
Yes.
But it is also funny to think that today, anyone with a phone can look up a phone book anywhere.
Yeah, that's called the
anytime.
Internet.
Yeah, the Internet. No. We do that now. Back in 1996, the web was young. It did exist, but it wasn't as robust as it is today. So, I mean, there was no Google back in 1996, so that would have made it harder all by itself. There's some really odd moments in this movie. Now, all that being said, we do understand, like we said at the top of the show,
this
is for entertainment.
It is for entertainment purposes, and as much as Jonathan and I are kind of, eviscerating it a little bit right now, there are parts of it that are very entertaining and very funny.
Right. And it's designed to be a popcorn movie. Now, that gives it somewhat of a pass, if they had tried to make a movie that was as scientifically and technically accurate as possible, it probably would not have been as entertaining.
Sure.
Maybe they could have avoided some of the more melodramatic, emotionally manipulative scenes, which I found, I don't know, at the time I didn't find it as irritating, but I was also dumber back then.
Well, as an adult, you get more aware of that kind of thing. I mean, I don't know, I certainly don't fault, especially big blockbuster movies like this, on being light on the science, but things that are just blatantly not
not right.
Not science.
Yeah.
I'm kind of like, this script had to have gone through multiple treatments and all kinds of eyes. And I mean, studios like that are huge. It was enormous.
I think what would be fun to do maybe in the future is to come up with our list of movies that have the worst portrayal of science and technology. And not necessarily go through it like this. Like, this was a special thing that we did because I jokingly said that we should do it. And then our
listeners
said, yes, do it.
And the entire internet said, do that thing.
So this is what you get. But maybe in the future we'll do more of an episode where we just kind of talk about some of the more ridiculous depictions of technology, like Hackers, which has some really awful sequences. Like, essentially anything that has depicted hacking as some sort of video game.
The Net with Sandra Bullock.
The Net is another great one.
That was a thing.
But yeah, anything where hacking is essentially like you are
the plot.
You are actually making your way through a three-dimensional castle, and you have to avoid skeletons. And this is actually the way hacking works. And if you can get to the treasure room, you get the files. There is a movie like that. I can show you the video clip after this is done. So maybe we'll do that at some point and just kind of give you a rundown on some of the movies that have.
Or maybe do a few that are really good.
Yeah, there are a few out there that have done some great work in representing what technology can actually do.
And that wraps up this classic episode. You know, we would occasionally do these episodes where we would take a film that has a lot of technology in it. We've done it with the James Bond films, Star Wars, Independence Day, obviously, and we would go through and talk about how the technology was portrayed, how realistic was it, did it set unrealistic expectations. If you guys would like us to do any more of those, let us know. Tell us some of the movies that we should really take a look at and kind of dissect. But if you have any other suggestions, feel free to pop them my way. You can reach out on Twitter or Facebook. The handle for both is TechStuffHSW, and I'll talk to you again really soon.
Tech Stuff is an iHeartRadio production. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.